You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
Money is made, mostly. I got lucky. I worked hard and I got lucky. Money is usually not made the way I made it. I participated in the decade of my 30s in some absolutely stupendous discoveries. And I participated in size. If you take 15% of your net worth and you put it in something that gives you a 30-to-1 shot, that, you know, 15% of your net worth, the arithmetic is pretty simple. That 30% of your net worth could triple or quadruple your net worth. And that happened to me more than once.
Welcome to Mining Stock Education. My name is Brian Lenny. Today with me, I have Rick Rule, CEO of Rule Investment Media. In our conversation today, you're going to hear Rick's views on the current gold market, political risk, project financing, and his upcoming Prospect Generator Bootcamp, and of course, the Rule Investment Symposium. Rick, it's great to have you. Let's start with the gold price. All-time highs over the last 2 weeks. This despite GLD outflows and a lot of conversations I was having with other investors at PDAC last week. This was a real concern for them. How do you view the outflows from GLD? Is this a concern for you?
No, I think it's an opportunity. I think the fact that the gold price is up, while at least nominal interest rates are double where they were, and while there's at least comparative strength in the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies, I see this as very, very bullish. I would take issue with the fact that gold's at all-time highs. Gold's at all-time highs in nominal dollars. And people don't pay enough to the difference between nominal dollars and real dollars, which I think is one of the reasons why gold hasn't broken out further. The buyers in gold right now, I would suspect, are governmental organizations in countries that object to the external application of U.S. values and the weaponization of the U.S. government against the U.S. dollar. These are governments that don't trust us, but they trust us more than they trust each other. They're looking for a medium of exchange outside of the U.S. dollar that is fungible, that's not a ruble, that's not a renminbi, that's not a rupia. That's all gold. If concern about the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar really comes to investors' attention, I think you'll see foreign central bank buying, and I think you'll see retail buying. I would note, too, Brian, that I now have a double opt-in subscriber database that exceeds 80,000 people. And there's real retail interest in gold, but it's not in Western Europe and it's not in North America. The subscribers, including the young subscribers that I have, in places like Singapore, places like Japan, places like Sri Lanka, places like Nigeria, not only have an interest in gold, they're acting on that interest. It is in the advanced economies where the retail interest in gold doesn't exist. That's the only place. Now, we believe ourselves to be in relatively good condition, and relative to the rest of the world, I think that we are. We've been through 40 years of benign economic climate, 1982 to 2022. My belief is that that changed in 2022. And my belief, too, is that much like the understanding of our circumstance took 5 years from 1967 to 1972 to come to the attention of American and Canadian investors, the same thing will occur this time, which is to say that while the writing is on the wall, people have been conditioned by good times not to be afraid. If that condition changes, you'll see the gold price change. And by the way, too, Brian, I don't care if gold goes from 2000 to 2150. That's not why I own gold. I own gold because I'm afraid of a circumstance that causes gold to do what it did in the decade 2000 to 2010, which is to say increase in price sevenfold. A move to 2200, 2500 doesn't interest me in the slightest. A move to $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000, while the circumstances that accompany that move would be lousy, is what interests me.
It's a good segue to my next question involving political risk. It was sort of an education for me over the last month or so. I'm invested in a company called Solaris Resources. They have the Warwinsa project in Ecuador. And the Zijin took a, or is proposing a $130 million investment into Solaris. And at face value, like, you know what, this looks pretty good. What I wasn't aware of, and it, there was a fairly prominent investor on Twitter, and he said that the deal's not going to happen. And I think given his influence, that it's sort of stagnated the stock. But when I did more digging, I didn't realize that the Canadian government was reviewing the deal. And this despite Warwinsa being located in Ecuador. And I wondered your view on this situation or how it can be applied. Like, there's an arbitrage in the Osino acquisition with the Chinese company. This arbitrage to me would seemingly be because it's a Chinese company and the possibility that the deal gets blocked. What do you think?
Let's start by disclosing conflict. I'm also a shareholder of Solaris and a fairly large shareholder of Solaris. I got a lot of time for work and I got a lot of time for BD. You know, the genesis of this company doesn't get any better. And the asset's pretty damn good, too. The lesson it teaches about political risk is that political risk isn't where you face it. It isn't where you think you face it. There is social risk and political risk in Ecuador. But the fly in the ointment is not the Ecuadorian government. It's the Canadian government. People believe that the United States is riskless. People believe that Canada is riskless. Brian, investors need to understand that the most dangerous government is the one closest to them. What business does the Canadian government have territorially imposing its will on Ecuador in a transaction that involves an Ecuadorian asset owned by international investors to a Chinese company? The answer is none. The Canadian government seems to be importing the hubris and the stupidity of the American government, which increases the risk to Canadian and American investors. That risk isn't from China in this circumstance. They want to do a deal. It's not with Ecuador. They want to see a deal done. The fly in the ointment is the Canadians. And yet Canadians believe that they're not experiencing political risk in Canada. This is truly absurd. Now, sadly, as mining investors, we face political risk all the time because we're a capital-intensive business with a fixed asset base. If you and I owned a freighter or a supertanker or a mobile drilling rig and the government became as stupid as governments inevitably do, we could move. We could translate or transfer our assets to a port that was more welcoming. Sadly, mines are fixed assets and we can't do that. So we have to accommodate ourselves to political risk. And the first part of accommodation is understanding it. Understanding that the most dangerous government is the one that's the closest to you.
Right. So in terms of this deal, do you think it gets approved? Do you think it goes?
I do. I think it gets done. But the fact I think it doesn't make it true. The hubris of the Canadian government, like the hubris of the American government, is almost unbounded. And it might be that the Canadian government can cause its will to be imposed extraterritorially. It's worth noting that the management team of Solaris are Canadians. And they probably feel themselves constrained by the idiocy of Canadian law.
Yeah. You know, personally, as a libertarian, I never thought I would see a libertarian voted into any government around the world, let alone Argentina. Looking at what Milei has done in Argentina, you know, 2.5 months in seems sort of remarkable. And it does. I don't know if it really even seems real to me. I was wondering I guess it's a two-part question. Do you think that he will be able to, in fact, turn Argentina around? And the second part to that is, do you think we could ever see this in the West?
The probability is that the Argentine electorate will not have the patience to allow him to turn around. Voters around the world have an inevitable tendency to vote for free beer and a free lunch, understanding that it's never free. The skill that it took to take Argentina, which was in 1946, wealthier per capita than Canada, and turn it into the basket case it is today, was amazing. I read the other day that there were 14 million people in benefits in Argentina and 6 million working. In a democracy, that probably means that 14 million people vote against 6. The free beer and the free lunch that they hope they enjoy is paid for by a minority of the people in the population. And the external debts that Argentina faces are very high, so the challenges in front of Milei are very great. The fact that he was able to balance the budget after 60 days in office tells you something about the bloat. Whether or not the Argentines are willing to control the growth of government and privatize some of the industries in Argentina, whether or not they are willing to sacrifice enough to overcome what is now 80 years of idiocy, is a different question. It would not take much. It's a very, very, very wealthy place. If they allowed the rural economy, the exports from the rural economy, to strengthen the economy, as opposed to preside over transfers and strengthen the government, if they would allow the development of the Vaca Muerte shale basin, which some people say has more geologic prospectivity than the Permian, if they would consider privatizing YPF and using the proceeds of the sale of YPF and the utility network in Argentina, the country would be solvent. It doesn't take much. The question is, are they willing and are they able to do this? If Argentina faced the same reality that Chile faced in 1972 and privatized the pension scheme, what could happen is that Argentina could go within 5 years to a middle-income country. It took Chile 10 years to do that. Will they do it? That's a very different question. Could we ever have a Milei in the West? We have to break it, that is to say, the West, as far as they broke Argentina. It's interesting to know that the very wealthy people in Argentina are Peronistas. It's the young people and the poor who have understood that their government conspires against them while lying to them that voted libertarian. You have an odd circumstance where the wealthy people who avail themselves of political favor and store their liquid wealth in the United States or in Uruguay are the forces of socialism. And the workers, the small business people, the farmers, the drugstore owners are the people who support Milei. Will they have the patience? Will the old people who benefit by being kept at a starvation level while doing no work, allow the young people to have a future? It's an interesting question. I look forward to the result. Will Pan American be allowed to develop a 500 million ounce silver deposit in Argentina, which would be the second most profitable silver mine in the world, providing taxes, education, employment, development? Really good question.
Moving to Mexico, more political talk about open pit mining and its possible ban. I was wondering, is this just purely banter, or do you foresee this as something seriously that Mexico could do in the future?
I suspect that AMLO, as he's affectionately described, is subject to the same idiocy and the same financial backing that Biden is. That Angela Merkel was. It takes real talents to destroy a country like Mexico, but the politicians have managed to do it. There's an ideological opposition to progress. You look at what Pemex has achieved. They have taken a country with absolutely vast oil and gas wealth and turned themselves into a net importer of natural gas, and reduce their productive capacity in oil by 75%. It takes real skill to keep Mexico as poor as it is, given the incredible talent and hardworking nature of the Mexican people, and given the spectacular resource endowment that Mexico has. I note that AMLO's choice for the mines minister was the former minister of the environment. I'm not for environmental degradation, But I do think that Mexico has keystone industries, which is to say extractive industries, which they're doing their best to destroy. It would appear that they're taking their economic directive from Trudeau, who is trying to destroy Canada's oil industry, the industry that Canada is the best at.
Moving to project financing, you know, I think it's just over a year ago that G Mining, it was, again, this is something that I hadn't seen in a while. Their construction financing package for Tocantinzinho was debt, equity, and a royalty stream on the operating mine. It looks like that the royalty and streaming companies continue to be the best cost of capital available to the companies. What I wanted to ask you, because I think you're probably the best person to answer it, because you can answer from the creditor side of you and as an investor. Is there a rule of thumb of what you like to see in terms of debt to equity, or now the inclusion of a royalty and streaming on a construction financing package?
Right now, streaming is attractive capital. You pay an effective 5 or 6% current yield for giving up part of your upside. Randy Smallwood famously points out that very often in streaming deals, the stream involves the sale of something like 10 or 12% of the revenue for 50 or 60% of what would otherwise be the equity stack. If you genuinely believe that your company is undervalued, not if you're mouthing that to the market, this form of stream is often cheaper than equity. Now, in truth, if you regard your equity cost of capital as the difference between the net present value of free cash flows at current commodity prices and your enterprise value, many of these companies are not as undervalued as they claim. And their equity cost of capital is much lower than they claim. But for companies that are actually selling at a 50% discount to net asset value, which is to say their equity cost of capital exceeds 17%, by that metric, then obtaining 5 or 6% capital with regards to a stream, as opposed to a 17 or 18% cost of capital, when the cost of equity is figured as a discount between the enterprise value and the net present value, becomes very cheap.
Looking much further down the spectrum of development in terms of royalties, do you think there's a threshold in an exploration company's development where do they need to be of a certain size or part in the timing of where they are in the development cycle to sell that royalty? Or should it only come at the end when they're trying to construct it?
I think that depends again on their cost of capital and their ability to utilize the capital employed. The first place to look for capital is reducing G&A. Which companies are loath to do. The best place to look for equity right now is the mining industry, the companies themselves. They're enjoying pretty good free cash flow after 10 years of belt tightening. And if you are a really, truly prospective miner, if you're, let's say, Kennerland, with a highly regarded management team and the ability to stake broad geological concepts that, while early, have value, your best source of capital, either equity capital or project capital, is the industry, other sophisticated investors. If you are the lame, the halt, and the blind, which is to say if you're 75 or 80% of the listed juniors, the best thing you can do is raise any equity you can at any price. Your cost of capital is infinitely cheap because you're worth nothing and you have a market cap.
Each year, I look back on my performance as an investor, and I try to see mostly where I went wrong and correct that. I wanted to talk to you about goal setting.
Me too, by the way.
I wanted to talk to you about goal setting because it's something I sat down this year and I thought to myself, I wonder if I could be better at this. And so I wanted to get your opinion on an investor and what sort of goals you can set for the year ahead. Is it a matter of, I want to attain this percentage profit, or I don't want to make this mistake this year? How do you see it?
I start by thinking about what I want to accomplish intellectually for the year. I believe that I have to invest in myself. At age 71, by the way, I've done a lot of that. I have a lot of retained earnings. But when I was 30, I asked myself to invest 2 hours a day in focused education in my own specialties, which was to say, after I was done working and everything else, I would try to consume 2 hours a day, 7 days a week, of knowledge around oil and gas, around finance, and around mining. And I tried not just to read. I tried to employ the knowledge that I had just absorbed or do thought games as to how I might utilize that knowledge to become a better investor and to become a better allocator of capital on behalf of other people. That really, truly worked for me, Ryan. The knowledge that I forced myself to gain between the ages of 30 and 40 has inured to my benefit and my former client's benefit for three decades after that. That was the most important thing that I did. And so my goals were more intangible. They were more around gaining knowledge. Internally, what I decided to do was not return to the mistakes I made in my 20s. In my 20s, I hadn't understood that natural resource-based businesses are capital-intensive and cyclical, and that resources that were in favor were going to collapse and resources that were out of favor were going to ascend. And I didn't understand that I needed to maintain a balance sheet that had much more liquidity than I had otherwise thought prudent. When I enjoyed successes, I wanted to double down on those successes and redeploy all of the capital in hopes of generating the same percentage gain that I had enjoyed in the success, when the right thing to do was scrape some of that capital off the table into stable investments, into cash flow generating assets, and maintain some of the capital as liquidity so that I could survive tough times and take advantages of opportunities when they occurred. It took me till I was 30 to learn that. But part of my goal ever since has been to achieve sustainability, liquidity, solvency, and balance. I divide my portfolio now, and by the way, we're talking about material well-being. We could talk about other kinds of well-being in a different discussion because that's equally important. But I've developed a sort of a discipline to segregate my portfolio into buckets, and the buckets increase or decrease relative to the rest of the portfolio depending on where I see myself in the investment cycle. It seemed to me that for the last 10 years, there was more opportunity for me in bigger companies than small companies, because the cost of capital to small companies, while they complained about the cost of capital, was too high. If I'd go into private placements, they wouldn't give me warrants. Well, that's absolutely stupid. Why would I buy restricted stock in a company where 25 or 30% of expenditures go to G&A and not get a warrant to participate in the upside? That's just insane. So I found myself, investing in bigger, higher quality natural resource companies. Beginning in the COVID area in 2021, when hydrocarbons got out of favor, oil was a no-brainer. It was just absolutely a no-brainer. And I found myself reversing 30 years of practice where I wasn't so much in the oil business because everybody else was, to find that 75% of my resource portfolio was in hydrocarbons. Now I'm starting to balance that out. I still believe that the outlook for the oil business relative to the pricing of oil equities is superb, but I've already made the easy money. You know, the move in the oil price from $15 or $20, never mind zero, to $70 means that the easy money has been made. While I still maintain a lot of oil and gas in my stable portfolio, while I still enjoy that income, and while I still believe the outlook is good, I'm beginning to become riskier again. I'm coming back into the juniors because, lo and behold, I'm getting warrants. I'm seeing pre-money market caps for existing exploration juniors with assets in the $3 million range, not the $30 million range. And I'm seeing the ability to potentially materially impact their outcomes in small $1.5 million placements, where I look at the other placees and I see names like Ross Beatty, the Lundin Trust, the Work family. I see the ability for a group of fairly sophisticated investors to end up with a quarter of the company with a full warrant at reasonable valuations. And I haven't seen that for 10 years.
I've been lucky enough to be able to learn from a lot of people, and you being a huge part of the success. I've learned a ton from you. I think despite this, I've also made a ton of mistakes. And I guess my question is, do some things just have to be learned through experience? Like, because, you know, you can listen to people and you can or find the right people and they can say a lot of good things. But seemingly the stuff that you just talked about, you almost have to experience for you to actually come to grips with the weight of what you're saying.
Right. Look at my mentors. Adolf Lundin, Seymour Schulich, Ned Goodman, Peter Brown, Peter Kundal, Hugh Mogensen. The fact that I had those people spending hours with me, investing alongside me, guiding me, the fact that I still managed to make egregious mistakes with the mentors that I had in my 20s tells me that your successes are due to others and you have to own your mistakes. So don't feel bad about that. I seem to make a real mistake every 18 months. But I make them with a part of my portfolio that doesn't change my decision as to what to have for breakfast. I made a mistake in my mid-20s that caused me to go from being a very wealthy young man to having a negative net worth. I haven't made those kind of mistakes since. I haven't made an existential mistake since.
So I guess this is so cool. I've heard you talk about it before, that the speculation that you did earlier on in your career really paved the way for your investment later on. So how do you look at how wealth is gained over a lifetime? Is speculation truly the only way to get to that point where you can? Okay.
Absolutely not. Time. Two things. Money is made mostly. I got lucky. I worked hard and I got lucky. Money is usually not made the way I made it. I participated in the decade of my 30s in some absolutely stupendous discoveries. And I participated in size. If you take 15% of your net worth and you put it in something that gives you a 30-to-1 shot, that, you know, 15% of your net worth, the arithmetic is pretty simple. That 30% of your net worth could triple or quadruple your net worth. And that happened to me more than once. That doesn't happen to most people. In the speculative side, incredible increases in net worth usually occur by being a founder, taking extraordinarily large positions on cheap stock, working 10 years utilizing other people's money, and building a big company. The idea that a third-party speculator like myself could generate the wealth that I did on other people's effort, where I didn't get anywhere near the same number of founder shares that they did, makes me a very odd duck. Mostly, the money that's made in natural resource speculation is made by founders or by value-added merchant bankers, the Frank Giustras of the world. I have participated basically in every part of the equation, but unlike most, I made my money as a speculator as opposed to as a founder. Most people don't make their money that way. Most people make money by figuring out that the key to making money is two things: generating lots of utility for other people, generating value either by way of goods or services that your customers value more than they value your money, that they're willing to pay you for it, and developing a personal brand so that people that have money seek you out to consume the goods and services that you have to offer. The money is the delta between the utility that you create for others and the utility that you consume. to finance your lifestyle. Those are called savings. The second way that money is made then is by the application of those savings, compounding that wealth. And compounding takes time. The biggest sin of investors is thinking that their time preferences matter. When I was a young man, I wanted to make money that quarter or that year. And I thought the fact that I wanted something made a difference to the world or to the process of investing. I learned, sadly, that the world didn't care much about my time preference at all, and that money is made as a speculator in 5-year horizons, as an investor in 20-year horizons. So paradoxically, when I was in my 20s and I had lots of time left on Earth, I was very impatient. Now that I'm 71, I think in 5-year time periods and 15-year time periods. It's odd that as I become older and I have less time on Earth, that my patience has increased. It's not because my time preference has changed. It's because life has taught me that money is made via compounding, and compounding takes time. Anybody who ignores that isn't going to get rich.
Prospect generation is a great way to play the exploration game in the resource sector. You have a virtual boot camp upcoming in April on the 20th. Tell us more about it.
Well, Brian, it really started off as an exploration boot camp. Exploration is really out of favor now. It's hated. It's cheap, finally, which is why I'm there. You know, I like stuff that's cheap. I like it when I don't have to compete with people who are smarter than me. As you point out, statistically, the best way to speculate in exploration is prospect generation. The brokerage firms hate it because the prospect generators don't have to dilute, so there's no fees, so there's no research, so there's no salesman harping about it. The managers often don't like it because it's hard. They prefer dumb money to smart money. I, however, in 45 years in the racket, have invested, if my memory serves me well, in something like 70 prospect generators. The consequence of that is that I've participated in 23 or 24 economic discoveries, which is to say that my percentage of success is approaching 30%. In a market where statistically success is enjoyed by 1 in 3,000 entrants, which is to say statistically my success as a prospect generation specialist is 3 standard deviations better than the expected success of the TSXV. It is that simple equation, Brian, that draws me to prospect generation. It isn't sexy. It isn't a circumstance where in that 1 in 3,000 chance where you're right, you develop $1 billion from a $20 million asset base. Because statistically, taking a 1 in 3,000 chance at a 30-to-1 return is stupid. It's absolutely stupid. For those of your listeners who don't know about our boot camps, once every 3 months, we take a really deep dive into something. This is not an entertainment product. It's going to require 8 or 8.5 hours of your time, and we're going to give you way more information than you can absorb in 8.5 hours, but you'll have access to the recording for a year. In our uranium boot camp, and Brian, as you know, I know a lot about uranium, and I put on the boot camp, I had to play the damn tape 4 times. So when I tell you it's going to consume 8 hours of your time, that's a lie. It's going to consume 25 hours of your time. But you're going to get a lot. You're going to get a keynote speaker in every one of our boot camps that by themselves is worth the tuition. You're going to get 3 or 4 exhibitors that have been vetted. Doesn't mean the shares are going to go up. It means that the risk-reward probabilities are good enough that I've bought them. And you're going to get analysts from the sector who have years, decades of experience. You're going to get that for $99. And if you don't think you got your money's worth, email me and I'll give you your $99 back. Gold-plated money-back guarantee. You do it twice, by the way, and you don't get to sign up for the third boot camp. The boot camp is made to be consumed in conjunction with the Rule Classroom. If you go to ruleclassroom.com, there are 200 hours of instructional programming to teach you how to become a better mining or oil and gas investor. The idea is that you avail yourself of as much of that free content, those free lessons, as you can, and then you employ the lessons in the Rule Classroom at the boot camps. You get a deeper understanding and you learn how to employ that generalist knowledge in a very, very, very specific area. Brian, you will come out of that a better investor. I'll come out of it being a better prospect generation investor. And I've been investing in prospect generation now for 45 years. I will benefit from that 8.5 hours. The keynote speaker is a guy, a really close friend of mine, a wonderful man, named Steve Enders. Four things to know about Steve Enders. He's been the chairman of a couple prospect generators, including EMX Royalty. More importantly, he's been on the staff of the Colorado School of Mines as a professor of exploration and geology for 3 decades. So he has lots of knowledge and he knows how to impart it. In addition to that, he was head of worldwide exploration for Phelps Dodge, then the largest copper mining company in the world, meaning that he would consume the intellectual knowledge of the prospect generators from the point of view of a very sophisticated check writer. And then he was the head of worldwide exploration for Newmont. Now, this guy is the nexus of prospect generation. He knows it intellectually as a professor. He knows it as a consumer at Phelps Dodge and Newmont. He knows it as an investor from being the chairman of the board and a personal investor in a couple prospect generators. There could not be a better keynote speaker than Steve Enders.
Speaking of prospect generation, Kenderland, as we were kind of discussing before, they converted their 20% position in Frotet into a 4% NSR. I think it's a great deal. The market did react to it, but what do you think of the deal? Do you think that's...
I think it's a great deal.
Yeah.
Their partner, Sumitomo, would much rather pay them a royalty than have them be a 25% participating interest holder where they may or may not be able to keep up with the capital calls to build the mine. And Sumitomo certainly doesn't want Kenderland questioning the amortization of the carpet expense at head office as a 25% shareholder. They would much rather send them a check and not have to explain anything to anybody. Meanwhile, the market will understand a lot more about the potential for free cash flow out of a 4% royalty than they would about the return on capital employed when the amount of capital that has to be spent on mine development is uncertain and the outcome is uncertain. The market tends to value high-quality royalties at a premium to the net present value of their free cash flows. The market right now seems to be valuing minority working interests at a 25 or 30% discount to the net present value. So the idea that you can at once eliminate your risk while also tripling the market's appreciation of the net present value means that this is the perfect transaction for them. I suspect that this royalty ultimately, as we get nearer to production, will be worth more than the current market capitalization of Kenderland without valuing the $20 million in cash that they have or their other exploration projects. I don't think that you can assign that net present value to it today because you don't know the start date of production. But once you know the start date of production, you have a reasonable sense from the feasibility study of what nameplate capacity looks like. I think this is going to be a very valuable royalty.
The world-class Rural Symposium on Natural Resources is upcoming in July in Boca Raton, Florida. Handpicked companies, you know, a host of the top speakers in the sector. What can investors expect from this event this year?
Well, first of all, the investors need to understand that the symposium has gone on for 30 years. It stood the test of time. It is, I believe, the best natural resources investment conference on the planet. It's hard work. If you're coming for amusement, if you're coming for entertainment, don't come. This is 4 days, 12 hours a day. If you can't come in person, you can attend it like 1,300 other people did last year, live stream. But I would prefer that you came in person. The reason is that there's a lot of things that take place at a conference like that that you can't tape. The interaction between attendees, most of whom are very high net worth and very experienced themselves. The ability to follow Ross Beaty or Bob Quartermain or Robert Friedland around the exhibit hall and see which companies they're talking to and eavesdrop perhaps on the questions that they're asking. The ability to get big picture perspectives on global macro, not from the politicians or from the popular media, but rather from the Jim Rickards, the Daniela DiMartino Booths, the Nomi Prince, people who talk about the world the way it is, not the way the big thinkers wish it was, is very useful. The ability to ask these people your questions in real time, either at the conference or on the boat cruises, where the speakers invariably are available for you to buttonhole them over a beer. Now, once you've gotten this global perspective, you get the advantage of people who have been lifetime analysts and portfolio managers in natural resources, who could teach you how to use this knowledge to impact your own portfolio. As you mentioned, at our conference, every single public company has to be owned in accounts owned and managed by me. They're all vetted. Now, Brian, as you know, sadly, the fact that I own something doesn't mean that it goes up in price. At every other conference I know of, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. That's it. So much of the exhibit hall is polluted with the lame, the halt, and the blind. You won't find that at our conference. And then, of course, there's the living legends, the Robert Friedlands of the world, the Ross Beatties of the world, the Bob Quartermains of the world. You will hear from people who have built multi-billion dollar companies from scratch. You'll hear how they did it. You'll learn how the lessons that they learned made them better investors. You'll hear, because I'll ask them personally on stage, what they're investing in now and why. You'll learn how the lessons that they learned made them better investors and how they can make you a better investor too. Whether you attend in person, which would be my preference, or live stream from the comfort of your own home, the tuition is fully refundable if you don't feel that you have gotten sufficient benefit from the conference relative to the money that you paid me to attend. And just like the boot camp, the recordings of the conference will be available. And if you have any brains at all, you will attend once physically and three or four times virtually. As you suggest, it's in Boca Raton, Florida, July 7th through 11th. I also need to say, if you come physically, bring your spouse, because the Boca Raton Resort is a truly spectacular place. It sits on 245 acres in Boca Raton. The owner, Michael Dell, has $1.4 billion in the resort. There's almost half a mile of Atlantic Ocean waterfront and half a mile of waterfront on the Intercoastal Canal. It has the single nicest conference facility that I've ever been in. When I first saw the facility, I thought, you know what? There's too much space here. It turns out for a good conference, there's no such thing as too much space. The accommodations that you'll stay in have a rack rate of $1,100 per night. Because we take a lot of them and we guarantee your attendance, we can turn these to our attendees for $315 a night. The point of this is that we're going to work you very hard during the day, but there's going to be a lot of ability to have some fun for your spouse or for you at night. Importantly, like our Vancouver conference, there's an optional attendee boat cruise where you and 350 or 400 of your closest friends and our speakers can go up and down the coastal canal with an open bar. The alcohol's on me. This is an event, if you're a serious speculator in natural resources, that you have to attend, either physically or virtually.
Excellent. Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today. Links to the boot camp and to the Rural Symposium will be below in the description. Until next time.
Great. Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope to see you in Boca.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.